for this argument, students from Edgar High School. Is it Edgar or Edgar? Edgar. Please stand up. Would the students from Edgar stand up? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. We also have another guest with us, Aaron Wells, if he would stand. Mr. Wells is a student who is shadowing his uncle, Justice Lewis Butler, today. And Mr. Wells is interested in a career in the law. So we expect a great deal from the lawyers in this argument so that he is not discouraged from that procedure. You're welcome, Mr. Wells, and you may be seated. And from the justices, yes. The heat is on all of us. With introducing you, I should say that you are part of the Court with Class program, which is a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar. And this court, we invite students from all over the state to come and hear an oral argument, and if they accept the invitation, the students are given the briefs. They may do extra work on the case and then come and listen to an oral argument. And then as part of the program, a justice meets with the student after the second case in order to discuss the proceedings of the court, not the substantive issues in the case. Let me introduce the court to you all. We'll start out with Justice Lewis Butler, who's on my far left. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and I will meet with you at noon. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, we'll call our second case today, which is 03-1878 CR State versus Henry G. Wagner. Arguing on behalf of Henry Wagner is John Wasluski. And then Jeffrey Castle, Assistant Attorney General, will argue on behalf of the state, and you will then have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Wasluski. Counsel, you may proceed.
Your Honors, Mr. Castle, honored guests, my name is John Wasluski. I'm here on behalf of the defendant, appellant, petitioner, Henry Wagner. Do you abuse alcohol or drugs? That's the question that brings this case before the court this morning. Mr. Wagner was stopped in a traffic stop. He was arrested on warrants. One factual question in this case is, did the arresting officer, the officer who later questioned Mr. Wagner, know that these warrants were drug-related? Clearly, the warrant was drug-related. One of these warrants, the record tells us, was for a drug paraphernalia charge. Whether Officer Saftig, the officer who made the arrest and later questioned Mr. Wagner, knew this at the time, is a question that was never addressed in the trial court.
Counselor, what kind of traffic violation was he stopped for? I've kind of forgotten.
I believe it was speeding.
Speeding? Okay. So it didn't have anything to do with use of alcohol or drugs, as far as you know.
The reasons for the actual stop,
yeah,
as far as I know, it did not.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Wasluski, if I could also follow up on Justice Rogensack's questions. I looked at the briefs and the materials and the memos that we had prepared. I hadn't gone back and looked at the record yet. How detailed was the questioning of the police officer regarding the questions and answers that were given by the officer and by Mr. Wagner?
I would have to characterize that as not detailed at all. What the officer basically testified to is, he went through this questionnaire, and in response to questions, this is what Mr. Wagner said. He is a drug user. He has a heroin addiction. It's a $100 a day habit. He'd started increasing his use in the past 6 weeks because of pain he'd suffered from an auto accident. I guess from the record, you can't tell, was this question then answer, then question, then answer, or did it all spew forth in one answer? I can't answer that from this record. I don't know.
Yeah, well, Just in that same area, the reason for these questions, say in drug and alcohol, over the past several years have been, I think, incidents of people that have been entered into the various jails around the state of Wisconsin that have had some difficulty with either one as far as how they're treated, whether there will be withdrawal, other complications. These are more or less routine questions, aren't they?
Well, I think the record tells us that they're routine in the municipality of West Allis, because the officer's testimony was, after he described what goes through a booking and how they handle the property and so forth, and then there's a medical questionnaire. It apparently is done in every case in West Allis. I can tell you from personal experience outside the record, if that's permissible.
No, just
from the record here, one municipality, it's a routine practice.
Does the record reflect at all where the municipality got these questions? In other words, are they based on U.S. Justice Department's suggestions or the Wisconsin Attorney General's suggestions? Where did they come from?
I have no idea, Your Honor. I do know that they had difficulty procuring this at the Miranda Goodchild hearing. The actual copy of the questionnaire, which is page 114 in the appendix, it's reproduced there. But who drew up these questions and what was in the mind of the person who drew them up at the time and whether they were copied from some other source are all questions I can't answer from this record.
Thank you.
Well, what's your objection to these questions? I mean, they sound to me like good practice for a jail or any place a person is held in custody to know whether the inmate has particular problems. Now, if the person is an abuser of alcohol or drugs, you might have significant withdrawal symptoms, which might be treated in one way. Or if the person has withdrawal symptoms and you have no reason to think he's on drugs or alcohol, you might think that these symptoms are caused by something else. If you've got somebody who has particular issues, they may indicate suicidal tendencies, and you do certain things for someone whom you suspect might be suicidal. So why, for the protection of the individual, and why not for good jail practices, shouldn't these questions be asked?
Well, as I look at the questionnaire and all the questions in it, the only two that I think might be objectionable are the one that's really at issue here, do you abuse alcohol and drugs? And the reason I find that objectionable is because it pretty squarely asks, do you engage in criminal conduct?
Well,
that is the criminal conduct of using and thereby almost necessarily possessing drugs.
You can abuse alcohol, but you're not going to get in trouble with the law unless you're driving or hitting somebody. But if you drink yourself to stupor in your own home quietly.
It doesn't say illicit drugs. I mean, there are, you know, prescription drugs. I could just mention OxyContin, pain drugs that people are on, that there could be a withdrawal difficulty, and particularly when they're placed in confinement, which I would think the jailer or the personnel there would want to know about.
Well, if you look at the questions, the first one would address prescribed the second question in the third portion of the booking questionnaire asks, are you currently using any prescription medications? So by necessary implication, the second to the last question, do you abuse alcohol and drugs, is asking for something more, something outside the legally prescribed realm. And the word abuse implies that as well.
Well, people abuse prescriptive drugs. Is that what you're saying is outside of the realm if they're using more than they should?
That's one possibility.
Or getting them illegally.
Illegally or getting more than their doctor recommends they have through improper means. But the underlying thing that I think the jailers would want to know is this person in medical distress? And there's a catch-all question for that as well at the end. Is there any other medical problems we should know about? And I think that this questionnaire, in general, addresses proper needs toward the care of the inmate, but I think those needs can be accomplished, those administrative needs can be satisfied, without asking a directly incriminating question.
Well, suppose they had asked, are there any other medical problems, and they didn't ask about abuse, and your client said, I'm a heroin addict, and I've increased my dosage in the last X number of weeks because I'm in pain, and my habit requires $100 a day.
In other words, if he had said just what he'd said here.
Exactly. And you had a general question that says, do you have any medical problems that we should know about so that we can even go further, so that we can properly take care of you in this facility?
Then I think you'd have to fall back on the test that is applied in most every case that addresses the routine booking question exception, which is, when the officer asked it, was he in a position where he reasonably should have known that this was going to lead to an incriminating response? My point with the question that was asked, and to which I am objecting, is the question on its face is calls for an incriminating response without going into the context or what the officer knew or what the charge of arrest really was.
Okay, so that in this particular case, you don't want the general test of objective test, right? Would an officer reasonably know it's incriminating, because you think on the face, you have to know it's incriminating.
I think that's the easiest place to start, and I believe that's the easiest place to end in this case. It's incriminating on its face. If the court doesn't see it as incriminating on its face, then I still think this court would have to follow that same test of would an officer in Officer Saftik's position reasonably have known that this question would lead to an incriminating response. And I think you get to the same answer, which is yes.
So you don't apply the objective test to a what would seem to be an innocuous question like, what's your name? Although that can be troublesome, too. Or what's your hair color? What do you dye your hair?
You're saying, when do you apply such a
test? You would not apply an automatic test that it's a bad question to what appears to be an innocuous question on its face. Like, what's your name, right?
Well, thinking as a trial lawyer, my answer to that would be I'd look at the case that's about to go in front of a jury and say, is the answer to that question going to harm my client? Is it incriminating to him? And then I would object to its use if the answer to that in my mind is yes, and then we come to that objective test.
That's
most times, I think this booking information goes into a file and never gets into a courtroom, let alone gets litigated.
Well, maybe you should say that all booking information that is set forth in response to questions cannot be used against your client, but they can only be used for treatment in the jail.
That's precisely what California did for a period of about 8 years, and I've set forth the cases where that standard was set forth. The jail can ask any questions that aren't administratively necessary. The answers to those questions can't be used as evidence in the substantive charge. And for 8 years, that seemed to work fine, and it was repealed due to an interpretation of a California constitutional amendment.
What was revealed here to the jail personnel was that because of the, quote, tracks in his arms and his statement about heroin use, that he had hepatitis C, which is I think a more common from a needle situation, but it would certainly be something they would want to know in jail, the fact that he did suffer from that.
Oh. You're drawing an inference that I don't have the medical knowledge to draw as far as...
Well, the inference, I'm just drawing it from the 114, when they check in great big, and they're starring it, hepatitis C. And as far as, do you have any of the following conditions? Well, he had alcoholism, drug addiction, and then it's checked hepatitis and hepatitis C. What I'm just stating is that is something that they would probably like to know and would want to know since they were going to have the person incarcerated. No different than if he had herpes, syphilis, heart problems, et cetera, et cetera. They would want to know that.
Yes, and I think that it could be determined without the question that was asked here. It could, do you have any infectious diseases? Mm-hmm. Would satisfy that need without going into the details.
Well, how long did you get them? How did you get them? That would be going too far. Just, do you have any? Yes. What is it? Hepatitis C.
Well, unless the jail has some basis to treat him differently based on how long he had it or treat him differently, I think do you have it is enough. But the point here is, and you used the interesting words, jail personnel. The questioning officer is Officer Safdig of the West Dallas Police Department. My client was at that time in custody on warrants.
Right.
He's in a municipal police department. He's going to be transferred to the county jail.
Yes.
There's no... The record's pretty deficient on what exactly happened, how many hours he spent in the custody of the municipal authorities before he was transferred to the jail, but most medical conditions that require any continuing treatment are going to be addressed at some other location by other personnel. Officer Safdig also is just that, the arresting officer. He's not. There's nothing to show that he has any medical training. He's just reading a questionnaire and jotting down the answers he hears.
This information would be given to someone else. The officer is procuring the information, the booking information, to be given to the jail.
Right, but the record doesn't even tell whether this questionnaire was forwarded to the jail. There was some discussion in the record about when Officer Safdig was testifying at the Miranda Goodchild hearing, do you have this questionnaire? No, we're all trying to get it. And then later on in the day, it appeared, and I don't know if it was procured. The record doesn't tell us if it came from Milwaukee County Jail, which would have been right in the courthouse complex in Milwaukee, or whether it came from West Dallas.
But it's labeled medical intake report. That's what it's labeled.
Right, West Dallas Police Department medical intake report.
Mm-hmm. Where did he wind up, do you know? I mean, he's taken by the West Dallas Police Department. They take him in because there's a warrant. You think that that's ultimately a state offense and therefore is going to go to county jail.
That would be the normal course of things. Whether
so
that
do
happened.
You know whether he ever went to county jail? You don't?
I'm only assuming he did. I don't know that.
But you don't know that from the record. And you don't know what West Dallas Police Department did with this medical intake report other than that the DA's office has it or had it.
The DA's office actually didn't have it until after Officer Safdig finished testifying. And
At the hearing.
At the Miranda Goodchild hearing.
And then they got it.
Then they got it.
So it's not a matter of course to give it to the DA if there's a prosecution and you don't know what the matter of course it is.
It certainly didn't happen in this case. I think it was only due to what Officer Safdig said about the questions and answers that prompted somebody to say we should get this.
Well, we recognize that booking questions don't need a Miranda. I mean, that's the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized that. We've recognized that, right?
There is a booking exception, yes.
Right. So now the question comes, what does booking questions mean? And obviously there may be different police departments and sheriff's departments that might use different booking procedures and questions, right? So now we have to have some kind of rules that are going to tell us how to deal with what is a booking question that comes under the exception, right?
Correct.
All right. One rule is the California old rule that you can ask anything you want, but it can't be used as evidence.
Correct.
I may be overstating it, but second way of dealing with the problem is as soon as you take him in and start the booking process and he's in custody, you give him a Miranda warning. Right?
That would satisfy this.
Right. I'm just trying to see where we go. The third way of dealing with this kind of case is you can ask questions, but you cannot ask a question that on its face asks for an answer that violates the criminal code. So you can't ask, do you use illicit drugs, because a potential answer is incriminating.
That is my argument.
That's your argument. And therefore, you can't use the response against the defendant at trial. That's your argument.
It is.
A fourth way of saying is that you don't decide whether it's an incriminating response or not per se, because you're asking for a per se rule as to any question that might incriminate on its face. Another way of saying is all questions are subject to the reasonably objective standard. Would a reasonably objective person believe that it might incriminate somebody under the circumstances of the case?
Well, I guess I view it more as a two-tiered analysis where you'd first say, is this question incriminating on its face? And if the answer is yes, you stop there, it was improper. If the answer is no, then you go on to the second part.
You don't have to do that. Do it as two-part. You could just say, hey, we're eliminating that first step. Nothing is per se. Everything comes under reasonably objective.
That's true. But
okay. That's not to your interest here, but it's true. It's not to your interest to say everything comes under the reasonably objective standard, your client's interest in this case.
Well, I think if you use that same standard,
you will anyway.
You will reach the same result. It's an incriminating question. The difficulty, of course, comes when you're looking with a questionnaire like this, and it's difficult to say that Officer Safter formed an opinion as to each question whether the answer might be incriminating before he asked it. I think he was doing this more or less by rote.
Well, I have another question. In some of the cases, it doesn't matter whether the particular officer knows something. What matters is whether the whole law enforcement area knows something. So for probable cause, it doesn't matter whether that officer knows, it's whether his colleagues know, right? So my point here is, why don't we apply that same test here? Someone in law enforcement knew that that warrant was for a drug case, right?
That's correct.
If we apply what's in the knowledge of the department, could have found that out, I assume. If they apply what's in the knowledge of the department, then this officer is held to know that he's got a drug charge against him, and therefore this can be incriminating. I didn't see that argument in your brief.
No, I failed to make it, and it's a good one, Your Honor.
Thank you.
My argument was that if you consider Officer Saftig's position, making this traffic stop, finding out Mr. Wagner had warrants, what officer would just take that at face value and not say, oh, what are the warrants for? Is this person a suspected litterer or a suspected killer? It would make a big difference to the officer's own security and safety and how he views Mr. Wagner in terms of handcuffing him, not handcuffing him. I just find it inconceivable to draw the inference that I believe the Court of Appeals drew, that silence means Officer Saftig was blissfully ignorant that one of these warrants was for a drug-related offense.
Mr. Vasilevsky, I'm not quite sure I understand what you're trying to achieve here except a new trial. Would you be happy if the Court said, just strike that question, do you abuse alcohol and drugs? Would everything else on the questionnaire be all right?
The only other one that I addressed in my brief, and it really has no effect on Mr. Wagner in this fact situation, is there is a question here about if this is your first time here in secure custody. And I read that and scratched my head what that has to do with anything medical. And it does seem to draw out, ask for, you know, have you been arrested and for what? And that line of questioning that I don't think is relevant. But I don't think that this, I don't anticipate that this Court is expecting to ratify or modify in whole a particular questionnaire that a particular police department is elected to use, but rather to give broader guidance for what various departments presumably use.
Are you asking that Miranda warnings be given?
I think what I would ask first is that this court consider the California option, that I think the more the jails feel the need to know it for administrative purposes, the more likely they are going to encroach on areas which may result in incriminating information. And I think a prophylactic rule will solve that. And if it's truly for purposes of providing medical treatment, I think those needs can be satisfied best that way. I also wonder what would have happened in Mr. Wagner's case. There's nothing in the record to show, despite his answers to these questions about being a heroin addict, that he was ever referred for any kind of treatment. That may be just a vacuum in the a vacant spot in the record, but as far as I know, he never was treated.
But, Counselor, if we were to use the Miranda warning, telling him that anything he says can and will be used against him, and that prevents him from saying he's a heroin addict, and he goes into withdrawal and has seizures from which he could die, then how is the jail going to know what happened? Someone in Dane County Jail died with diabetic seizures or some such thing, or maybe it was Milwaukee Jail, I'm not sure which one, but recently, in the last year or so. And apparently, the jail wasn't aware of what his medical problems were. So, you know, if we say, well, you better give the Miranda warnings, and then because of that, he doesn't answer the question, that really isn't in your client's interest, is it? I mean, you put him then at risk for not saying what the jail would need to know if he had a severe reaction to his addiction, be it alcohol or drugs.
That's another argument that I think tends toward the argument I'm making. A prophylactic rule would protect the inmate, protect the jail.
So you'd like him to answer, you just don't want his answers to be used. It's pretty much that simple, right?
Right, and then I think jails would truly ask what they truly need to know for booking and no more. And there wouldn't be any thought of whether booking questions were being used in a subversive sort of way to get incriminating information, which of course is clearly prohibited under black letter laws that exists now.
Counsel, don't you have another problem with the record here, though? If you look at the record, if you look at the booking questionnaire, assume for sake of argument that the court were to say that the question, do you abuse alcohol, drugs, which calls for a yes-no answer and actually has a box for yes-no. Assume that we say that that question does not call for an incriminating response. What we have in the record here is a separate line where heroin is written, and then you have all the description of the $100 they have it and what else, which suggests that there was more conversation going on than just simply reading the questions and getting the answer to the questions. Unless we have the detailed conversation, how can we say, or how do we know whether this officer asked questions likely to bring about an incriminating response as follow-ups to the questionnaire that are outside of the questionnaire?
Well, I clearly have a stronger case if it were a matter of record that Officer Saftig asked, well, how much did your habit cost? How long have you been using? There are other questions that aren't answered, like, where do you get the $100 a day to support this habit? There are many things that aren't in this record, and I regret that. And I sense in reading the record that trial counsel, while he fought valiantly, wasn't real familiar with the booking exception. And when it was thrown at him, his response was, I don't see what's routine about asking a person whether they've violated the law, or something to that effect, I believe, was the first thing out of his mouth at argument. But I don't think that that precludes this court from saying that the state failed to meet its burden, when you get to an incriminating question, you get back to Miranda before you can ask an incriminating question, or when you reasonably know should lead to an incriminating answer. You get back to Miranda, and the burden's on the state to show that Miranda's complied with, and I'm saying this question fell within the scope where Miranda should have been given before it could be asked.
Counselor, what if we agree with you that We don't give Miranda, but we can't use any of the answers to the questions. Well, what about if the officer asks the question, do you abuse drugs? And the guy is real nervous, and he says, yeah, I abuse drugs, and I, you know, I didn't really mean it. It was my drug habit that made me hold up this bakery, and goes on and on with a lot of voluntary information. Where does that put us? Is there any line that you would draw where when the answers are beyond the scope of the question that was asked, that we don't have to say the state can't use those answers?
Well,
when you ask the question, do you just end up having to ditch everything he says after that?
Well, when someone asks me, how are you today, I could say fine, and that answers the question, or I could go into a litany of my various aches and pains and complaints, but they're directly related to the question, how are you today? And likewise, do you use alcohol or drugs? Brings up a topic that the answer to was responsive to the topic, if not the specific question, not the specific yes-no answer.
But then can't a defendant somewhat immunize himself by blabbing all over in response to a question that could be yes or no, and a later Miranda warning under our case law will not permit that same question to be asked and then answered and the answer to be used. So can he kind of immunize himself then by just talking and talking?
So
any admissions he'd make later after the Miranda warning is given, then how can the state ever use those if he's blabbed about them in regard to the question? It's just hard to draw lines. That's what I'm having trouble with.
Well, this is a situation that's custodial interrogation, first off.
Oh, sure.
And
but I thought you and I agreed you didn't want the Miranda warnings given because if he doesn't answer a question that could be detrimental to his health, then really in a way your client's put at risk. Okay? So if we don't have to give the Miranda warnings and he goes on and answers questions beyond that are incriminating, where do you draw the line? Doesn't he essentially immunize himself for anything he may say after a later Miranda?
Well, I think it has to be... again, it comes back to the choice of questions made here. Do you abuse alcohol or drugs?
Right.
Which I think is broader than the jail needs for its purposes. But
even if he has seizures from the drug withdrawal or from alcoholism, which is not a crime, and goes into DTs and the jail doesn't know that that may be a problem, and now he's unconscious, how are we going to find out what we're going to do with this guy to take care of him?
Well, if you follow the prophylactic rule, you've got the same problem you brought up before. If he blabs more than he's asked and it can't be used, that's a problem for the prosecution.
That's right, I'm having.
But the prophylactic rule will certainly give anybody arrested every incentive to give whatever information is needed to provide adequate medical treatment. I think it's the prophylactic rule is best suited for looking at it from the purposes of protecting jails from liability and protecting inmates from suffering medical consequences due to not revealing their condition.
Right, but it also has the potential for immunizing criminals for any incriminating statements they may choose to make, and any later Miranda warning isn't going to cure that problem.
That, you know, I think if this course came up with a prophylactic rule that said you don't have to, you can ask whatever you want and it can't be used, I think individual jurisdictions could still be free to ask anything they want once they give Miranda. And that, I don't think that's a call this court has to make.
Okay.
In other words, if you are for the prophylactic rule, but, you know, the ABC Police Department doesn't like it and wants to give Miranda and ask what they want and use whatever they hear, that can be an option that any jurisdiction could choose, even if this court granted my request and imposed the prophylactic rule. So there, the call could be made by the individual jurisdiction. I also think you can draw a line to some degree with the defendant who blabs a somewhat responsive answer, as Mr. Wagner did. His answer addressed his alcohol and drug abuse.
But he also said,
oh, by the way, I buried my grandmother in the cellar, that had nothing to do with the question, I think you'd have a harder time saying that that was immunized.
But he didn't have to tell the officer he had heroin in the syringe out in his car either, did he?
The record deficiency and the fact that we don't know if there were follow-up questions or if this was all spewed forth at once makes that hard to answer.
Yeah, I can see your point.
It's like the bruises and cuts. If he said, yes, I have bruises or I have cuts or have tracks on my arm. I mean, he could have said cuts or bruises, but he apparently, allegedly said tracks on his arm. I mean, and that's indicative of some other activity rather than, you know, you picked it up from playing softball.
Well, I believe the tracks on the arms is under the section of observations rather than questions. I don't think that came from the lips of Henry Wagner.
Okay, booking officer's prison questionnaire. It says, this is the questionnaire. So I just took it as that it was a yes. It's in the same category as whether you abuse alcohol or drugs. I was just saying that it's...
Oh. Oh, I see where you're referring.
Right here. I'm reading from right down. It's the question, have you fainted recently or had a head injury? His answer was concussion from an auto injury. So he had to answer that. Next one, do you have any cuts or bruises, which would be the auto accident? And then he said tracks and arms.
It's in two places. It's in the observation of the officers.
Okay, but I'm just saying it's there on the document. Anyway, that's, never mind. I'm just showing you that it required an answer from the client.
It apparently did require both an observation by the officer and a response to a question, as I see this questionnaire.
Well, thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Castle.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. I am Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Castle, appearing today on behalf of the State of Wisconsin. I think it's important to clarify just what the issue is and what remedy, for the lack of a better word, would be appropriate if the Court were to agree with the defendant that these questions were improper absent Miranda warnings. In his brief to this Court, the defendant asserted that the police should not be allowed to ask this question, at least in the absence of signs of impairment or medical distress. And in his reply brief, argues that this question about abusing drugs or alcohol should be removed from the questionnaire. I think those contentions misperceive the issue before the Court. The issue is not what the police may ask arrestees. It is not whether the police may ask an arrestee about medical concerns or drug use prior to giving Miranda warnings. Rather, the issue, and it's a more narrow issue, is whether the answers to those questions may be used in the state's case, at least in the state's case in chief. I think regardless of whether this Court agrees with the defendant or with the state in this case, the police may ask arrestees questions seeking information relevant to their health or safety concerns, including questions about drug use, regardless of whether they have given the Miranda warnings. Now, whether the statements that defendant Henry Wagner gave in this case to the booking officer about his drug use depend on whether those questions come within the routine booking question exception that was first recognized by the United States Supreme Court in Muniz and adopted by this Court in Stevens. It's the State's position that those statements were admissible under the routine booking question exception. It is also the State's position that if the admission of those statements was error, that the error was harmless.
Let me start with the second part, the harmless error, if I may. I just took a look at the closing arguments, and boy, that's an exercise in brevity. The closing arguments of the State were about 2 pages of transcript, maybe 2.5 pages of transcript, and really only 2 points. The witness identified the defendant, and the defendant had a motive because he had to support his $100-a-day drug habit.
Given the import of the motivation here, why is it harmless?
I guess I would disagree that the motive was particularly important. I mean, I think in any case where someone robs a store, one presumes they're robbing it because they need money, whether it's to support a drug habit or for some other reason. The Henry Wagner, unfortunately, is not the only person in Milwaukee County with a drug habit who commits crimes to support that. The real issue, and really the only disputed issue at trial, was identification. How sound was the identification by the victim, the cashier at the bakery? May
I just interrupt? I mean, I agree with you. The only issue is identification. But again, looking at these 2.5 pages, there's only 2 points that are made. One is that the 2.5 pages talk about that, you know, she did a composite or something like that. But I mean, the 2 points are, number one, that she was absolutely sure, or I'm paraphrasing. Right. And the other point is he had a motive, $100 day habit, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and judge, and he sat down. You know, I mean, it was.
I don't quarrel with that description of the closing argument. Uh-huh. It's right. Those were the 2 points. But I think certainly the fact that a prosecutor brings up the evidence in a closing argument is by itself not determinative of a harmless error. And the reason there are only 2 points is there are really only 2 points. Really, there's not much evidence at the trial. There really...
Yeah, there's no DNA. It was all eyewitness and then motive.
There was
no
eyewitness. That was it. And frankly, it was a short argument. There wasn't a whole lot to say about the identification. She testified, the victim testified about, you know, what she saw, and there was evidence of more to back up that bolstered the strength of her identification. And I guess I would say, you know, if this were, I think you have to factor in the strength of the evidence. This was a strong identification. The defense says, well, you know, a one-person identification, and we all know about potential concerns about eyewitness IDs. But this was different in the sense that there was an interaction between the victim and the defendant before he pulled the knife. They were having kind of the ordinary, you know, what kind of cakes you got, let me have a half dozen cookies. They're kind of chatting away. So she has a good look at him before she's under the stress of being robbed, of having the knife pulled. So I think this is, as eyewitness identification cases goes, a very strong one.
With the exception of, I think, how many days was it after the event that the identification was made? That makes it a little weaker. I mean,
it was, I'm going to say, about a month or 6 weeks that the identification was made. However, right after the robbery, she was taken to the police station, did a sketch for the sketch artist, and I don't know that the sketch is in the record on appeal, but the trial court commented that there was a pretty close correlation between the sketch that she did contemporaneously with the robbery and what the trial court described as Mr. Wagner's distinctive features.
Didn't she also turn down another lineup of photos and say, nope, he's not there?
That's right. The first one, which was, I think, done before Mr. Wagner was arrested.
Right.
She said, no, it's not there. That's right.
No, I want to go back to the rule we have to draw and get off the harmless error for a minute. Yeah, I know the state thinks that these are proper booking questions, but just say we don't happen to agree. that we don't happen to agree they fall under the immunity from Miranda warnings. What kind of a rule, does the state have any fallback position on the kind of a rule they'd like this court to write for questions that might be asked at booking?
I think the rule is already in place. I mean, I think the rule is, does it serve, I mean, I think there's a threshold question. I don't think the state would contend that any question I ask during booking is proper. clearly asking an arrestee, you know, what other crimes have you committed that we might want to know about, would not come within. So I think there's a threshold question. Does the question asked serve a legitimate administrative need for the jail?
If I can stop you there, isn't really the operative question for us whether or not the question can elicit an incriminating response under Rhode Island versus Ennis? I mean, you phrase it in terms of administrative, but Miranda really applies if there's a likelihood of eliciting an incriminating response.
Right. I think before we get to that question, is there a likelihood of eliciting an incriminating to decide whether something is potentially within the routine booking question exception, we have to ask, can we call it a routine booking question? If it is, and then the question, which I think has to be determined on a case-by-case basis, is the Innis-based question.
And the question that was asked here, do you abuse alcohol drugs, clearly wasn't the type of question that was approved in Pennsylvania versus Muniz.
That's right.
Versus Stevens.
Right. And I think the question here, the state would acknowledge, goes beyond kind of those basic biographical questions that are used for processing. So I guess in that sense, the test we are suggesting, I won't say, maybe I will say, is a bit broader. That is the question seeking information for administrative purposes in the jail? And I think just as asking pedigree questions, who's your spouse, place of employment, a lot of things that the jail might want to know for booking questions, there is at least as important an administrative need.
And that may all be relevant for the administrative purposes of running the jail, but the issue that's before the court is whether or not Miranda applies. So the administrative purposes really are incidental. The real issue is whether or not the question is designed to elicit an incriminating response. And the reason I ask that and I try to get back to that issue is this particular question. When I look at the question, I then look at the entire chapter 961. I mean, the entire chapter, whether you're talking possession of drug paraphernalia, possession of controlled substance, possession with intent to deliver, delivery, certain types of drugs, the entire chapter is implicated indirectly, if not directly, by that question. Would you agree?
Yes.
It's
not the only, the question is certainly is much broader, as members of the court have pointed out during my colleague's presentation. The question is certainly much broader than that, but I would agree it encompasses 961 questions.
And the reason I bring up the question, it relates directly to something you have on page 12 of your brief, where you assert that regardless of whether Officer Saptik knew that Wagner previously had been charged with possession of drug paraphernalia, his questions to Wagner about drug use were not interrogation for purposes of Miranda because he was not investigating that charge, and his questions were not reasonably likely to incriminate, to elicit an incriminating response with respect to that charge. Didn't the United States Supreme Court in McNeil versus Wisconsin say that Miranda is not linked to a specific charge? That's only under Sixth Amendment.
Right, but we're looking but when, I guess I would go back to Innis, and what Innis talks about as an incriminating response, it's in a footnote, we refer to any response, whether inculpatory or exculpatory, that the prosecution may seek to introduce at trial. I guess then the question is, would a reasonable officer in this officer's position know that the prosecution might seek to use Wagner's statement? Let's assume this question were more narrowly phrased. Would a reasonable officer anticipate that this might elicit something that a prosecutor might seek to use at trial? And just a statement, yes, I use heroin. I don't know that that standing by itself is a response that an officer would anticipate would be used at trial.
Why can't the question be framed rather than would a reasonable officer know that the prosecutor might use the statement at trial, as you did? Why can't it be framed, would a reasonable officer know that the question would or likely would elicit incriminating evidence, incriminating statement?
If incriminating in the sense an admission
of an illegal activity,
then I think that's closer to what's going on here.
Well, I think it is closer to what's going on here because I look at this West Allis medical report. Now, I understand that there's a lack in the record, a dearth in the record, and I have this report, and so I don't believe the record indicates whether or not all of these items were asked in sequence. But let me infer that, whether or not that's a valid inference, we can debate it. But let me infer that generally people on questionnaires go down the line. And the first thing asked in the questionnaire that the officer fills out is arresting officer's observations. The next category is booking officer's visual opinion. And in that category, there is a question, are there any indications of self-mutilation harm? And here the officer wrote, needle tracks on both arms. So I'm assuming this went in sequence, and the officer filled this out as to observations. I think it reasonable for an officer to say if someone has needle tracks on both arms, that they've got illicit drug problem. I think that's reasonable. May not be the only reason for needle tracks on both arms, but I think that is a very reasonable observation. With that by way of observation having already been filled out, then you get to the questions. And the question is, do you abuse drugs? And the answer is heroin that's written in here. I mean, I would think, using your test, a reasonable officer, having observed prior to the question needle tracks on both arms, could reasonably conclude that a question, do you abuse drugs, would elicit a incriminating statement. What's wrong with that? It seems to me it's A, B, and C.
A couple of things, I think, perhaps wrong. Because I think your assumption that
it went in
order. We don't know whether Mr. Wagner had long sleeves on, and it wasn't until we got down to use it.
I have a son that wears short sleeves. In fact, yes. I have a son who wears short sleeves in November, December, January, February, and March. And I dare say there might be some students here that wear short sleeves in the middle of winter. So, there's no rule here. Long sleeves in winter.
So I guess I
don't hide your arms. I see the kids going.
my son wears t-shirts the entire year round, so I understand. I guess I'm not necessarily willing, therefore, to accept the premise that this officer knew when he asked the question that there were needle tracks.
We just don't know.
Right.
We just know what I think, what I said, that that is the observation listed. It may, you may or may not agree that it's reasonable that people on these things go down the list. But, you know, I suppose it's equally one as the other.
He may well have gone down the list and not noticed that, and then, but not checked it. We just don't know.
Let me assume that an officer going down the list first observed that the defendant had needle tracks on both arms. Let's assume that. Do you agree with me that a reasonable officer then could expect that a response to the question, do you abuse drugs, would likely elicit a statement of illegal activity after observing heroin tracks down the arms? Don't you agree with that?
Yeah, I think I would. I guess the question, though, is that the statement of illegal activity something that the officer would anticipate would be used by the prosecution? Being an addict is not a crime. Can't be a crime.
Being an addict for heroin isn't a crime, but possessing drug paraphernalia is a crime.
Right.
Possessing drugs, heroin, is a crime. And it is pretty reasonable to conclude that you are not a heroin addict unless you use heroin and use paraphernalia.
Sure, but the question under Innis is this
warrant on the basis of this? He answers the question, yeah, I'm a heroin addict. Can he get a search warrant? Probable cause to believe there's paraphernalia in his apartment or drugs?
Off the top of my head, I don't know the answer, whether that's enough to particularize it as to place, for example.
And once you do that, then you do have a crime.
Oh, sure, once with the possession.
Well, we have cases that say it's reasonable to infer that he keeps stuff at home.
Yeah.
We have cases that have held that. So what you're doing is moving along. And don't we have some cases that say if you get information after not giving Miranda that you can, what's the rules on the poisonous tree on testimonial?
Well, you know, eat from it.
Right. But you can use it to find other things. And then
I mean, there are a couple of recent U.S. Supreme Court cases. There's the Patan case that talks about physical fruits may be used.
That's right. That's what I'm getting at. So he says he's an addict. They can find physical fruit, even if it's as a result of his testimonial nature response.
And in fact, if they had asked him, presumably, you know, do you have any drugs in the car we might want to know about?
Right.
I think they could.
And they could use those once they found them. Because there's a cutoff there.
Yeah.
And let's get back to the question Justice Robinsack asked. Suppose he says more than he has to say here. He says not only that he's a heroin addict, but that he's got a $100 a day habit. Or then might say, and boy, it takes a lot of crime to feed that. Can they use that against him?
I'm sorry.
He talks more than he has to.
Right. Yeah, if it's volunteer, I don't think.
Well, that's the question. Is it volunteered if there's a direct question and it's all related to the direct question?
Well, we get to what defense counsel has suggested.
He wants a prophylactic. The question is, all of this, and if he says more than he should, that still would be not used. Be
and I don't agree with that.
Okay, well, what is the remedy? Let's just assume, for the sake of argument, that as Justice Bradley got you to the point where they know there's needle marks, which they observe, and I'm assuming they don't sit around here or let him sit around booking fully clothed in his winter coat and his jacket. I assume they take some of that clothing away from him.
Reasonable assumption, but
right, okay. So now they see the marks.
Well, but he
Now they ask him these questions, and let us assume they're not correct. It's beyond routine booking, all right? It doesn't fall within the exception. What do we do about it? What's the remedy?
Then the statements are suppressed.
They're suppressed. Okay. What about adopting the California law? You can ask him anything you want. You can't use it against him.
Well, that I don't know whether the California law originated as a statute, but I don't know what the basis for this court adopting that would be. It's constitutional. It's not constitutionally required.
No, but it sure makes life easier for the police, the jail, and courts. Right? You got a bright line rule.
But that would eliminate the routine booking question exception, which this court already has recognized.
But, Counselor, what about if we look at this as a refinement of the routine booking question? There are some questions that are not likely to elicit an incriminating response, though in a given case they might, like how old are you or what color hair do you have. But perhaps this question, while it may be needed to properly provide health care to him should he have an adverse problem because of his addiction, also has a propensity for leading to an incriminating response. Now, if we say that's the case for just a different class of questions, in other words, everything you ask at booking doesn't have to be a, quote, booking-exempt question. So we have that class of cases, as suggested by Justice Bradley. My concern is, what about the defendant that volunteers more than the answer to the question? How could we draw the line on that? In other words, he can practically immunize himself because enough.
I guess I don't, I'm not sure I agree that he would immunize himself.
You don't think so?
No.
If a Miranda warning was required for these questions, and we decided not to require it, but then to say they couldn't use the answers.
Well, I think...
Don't you get into problems with statements that were made when a Miranda warning should have been given, wasn't given, Miranda warnings later given, same questions asked, you get the same response?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if there's sufficient attenuation between the two, and we have the situation at one extreme, again, the Missouri versus Siebert case where there's a deliberate strategy.
Right.
Don't give Miranda warnings. Let's see what we can get, and then we'll immediately Mirandize. Right. Supreme Court said,
nope,
that doesn't work. But I don't know whether that would apply to, you know, a
but
good...
Just say this guy answers the questions in a similar way. You ask him, do you have a drug addiction? He said, yeah, I do. I got a $100 a day habit. I got a syringe and heroin out in my car. Okay, the only question was asked was the one that's on the booking sheet. And the guy thinks, holy Toledo, I've got all this information. And he reads him the Miranda rights, and then he asks him the same question, gets the same response. Then where are you?
Although, you know, I don't know, as a practical matter, you know, usually, it's my understanding, what happened in this case, we don't know. I mean, it's the Miranda rights would be asked at some point later by the detective.
Of course.
And you would ask then, was there sufficient attenuation between the booking?
No, it's the booking guy tells the interrogating officer all that he knows. Yeah. You can be sure he's going to ask the same questions. Why in the world wouldn't he?
He might. And I have to tell you, I'm not up enough on the attenuation law to answer that intelligently.
Okay, good.
Can I ask you, do you know anything about this form?
No, the record is, and with regard to the form and a lot of other things, this record is pretty barren. And that's, and in a sense, this is an unfortunate vehicle for this court to be trying to answer these questions because the record is barren. We know nothing.
There are jail inspectors from the state. Do they work for your department?
I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know if there are any administrative rules on...
I'm not aware of any.
...cover this?
No. And certainly we don't know who developed this form, whether it was, you know, the city attorney for West Allis or whether city attorney developed some of it and jailers added a few that they thought would be, we just don't know. And we also, we don't know a lot about the circumstances of the questioning. The record doesn't say a lot about the circumstances.
And let me ask you about that, if I can, Mr. Castle. On page 4 of your brief, you say some of Wagner's statements, the record does not say which, were not in response to any question but were volunteered by Wagner. Now, the obvious inference from that is that some of the responses were to questions. Does the record reflect which questions were asked that he responded to, other than generally the booking form?
It did not go, no, the record is.
So the attorney didn't go through that. Neither attorney went through that.
Neither attorney.
Last question. Who's got the burden and what is the burden in a Miranda Goodchild?
The state bears the burden by a preponderance of evidence on the issue of whether this was a custodial interrogation.
Well, there's no question it was a custodial interrogation, is there? I mean, as to the custody, whether it was an interrogation that falls with an exception of the Miranda rule is the question here.
There's no question he was in custody, no question he was not Mirandized before these questions were asked.
So depends whether it comes under the exception.
Mr. Castle, doesn't a jailer have to know whether someone going into the jail is likely to have withdrawal from drugs?
Well, I think it's a critical bit of information, sure.
Okay.
For the safety of the arrestee and as well as other inmates and jail personnel.
So is it a question of how the question is asked? I mean, would it make any difference if the question were, are you likely to go through any withdrawal symptoms if you're here for 48 hours? I mean, does that make any difference?
You know, I don't know that this question was particularly artfully drafted, but from the jail, I go back to the point I made at the beginning. I think the issue is not whether the jail can ask these. It's a question of how the answers are used. So I think, you know, even, as I said, the West Dallas Police Department can keep asking these questions if this court determines that the answers can't be used. Jails can and probably should ask these type of questions because they do need to know this kind of information.
What's the matter with that rule? You can ask what you want, but can't use them if it's reasonable to have an to suspect that there's going to be an incriminating answer.
That is the rule.
You can ask anything you want, and the test is the reasonable objective standard.
That's right.
And if it's reasonable and objective, then you suppress. What's the matter with saying that here he had to know, because of the information available through the law enforcement, that it was that this guy has a drug issue and there's a warrant out for drug paraphernalia? I mean, the state uses that all the time on search and seizure cases.
Right.
Why not do it the other way?
I can say what I have seen consistently in these cases has focused on the knowledge of the officer asking the question. So I gave the example in a footnote in my brief of two very similar cases out of North Carolina. In one case, it was the investigating officer who asked the question. In another, it was the jailer who knew nothing about.
No, but the general rule is you give the state the benefit of all the information. I think it's probable cause in cases.
Right.
So why not here say, look, the whole law enforcement community is held to the same standard when it's to the benefit of the defendant?
Because I think the purpose of the Innis question, the Miranda concern, is different than in the probable cause.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Castle.
Thank you.
Krzyzewski.
I would like to, if I may, address what I never reached when I spoke to you earlier, and that is the harmless error question. I believe it was correctly characterized that the
State's closing argument really only hit on two points. The witness identified Mr. Wagner as the robber, and the motive was heroin addiction that cost him $100 a day. What I find, though, more disturbing, even than using this as a motive, is using the fact of the drug addiction to impugn Mr. Wagner in front of the jury, and this is what I believe the State did in their rebuttal. There was apparently, judging from the wording of the rebuttal, a photograph of Mr. Wagner, and Mr. Wagner was in court, apparently looking very proper and well-groomed, and the prosecutor invited the jury to look at this photograph of Mr. Wagner, presumably taken shortly after his arrest, although that's really not set forth clearly.
Is that a new issue? Impugning the defendant?
Well, I raised it in the context of this is not harmless error because of the way that the improperly admitted evidence was used. I didn't raise it as a separate.
How do you really expect to do differently at a new trial? You have a very positive identification. The strategy of attacking the credibility of the victim didn't work the last time. You have someone who is a heroin addict, and there are going to be a lot of ways to prove that. You want to suppress the business about tracks on the arm as well? I mean, the prosecutor said, look at this photograph. This looks like a heroin addict.
That's what he did.
Yeah. And that photograph probably looks like the drawing that was constructed after the robbery. I mean, what is going to be different about the second trial? Maybe a few words won't come in, but what is going to be different? I think the State will be able to establish a motive because the defendant is a heroin addict.
And they would be able to try to prove that without using his own words. I don't see where the State's going to come up with a dollar amount per day that was admitted to, $100 a day, or all the details. I started using 6 weeks ago and increased use starting 6 weeks ago because of a car accident. All these words are being thrown right back at Mr. Wagner. That along with, I think it was objectionable here to say, hey, he looks like a heroin addict. That's not arguing the evidence of the motive. That's arguing this is a disgusting person who should be convicted. And I believe it was objectionable for that reason. It wasn't objected to. Perhaps I could have characterized it as an entirely separate issue, but I'm arguing it here as prejudicial. It caused this trial. It tipped the balance in this trial. And if this were prohibited, if there were a new trial, the State would be left with little more than here's a witness who 30 days later, 16-year-old bakery clerk, looked at a photo array. Another interesting question that's left wide open in this record is what prompted the West Dallas police, after arresting Mr. Wagner 30 days later, to decide, hey, let's throw this face in a photo array in front of this.
Maybe they looked at the drawing.
We can only speculate. I don't know the answer. I'd love to know. But there was this 30-day delay. It was a very young clerk. I think the State's argument that there was an interlude here where whoever this robber was a customer before he became a robber, and therefore the clerk had a chance to view a customer without the stress of this. I don't know that that goes that far unless you want to say a clerk would remember all her customers who are dealt with in a stress-free environment. I think this Court is well aware of the pitfalls of eyewitness identifications, and this is just that and nothing more. There is no DNA. There is no fingerprint. There is no surveillance photo. There is no confession. That's all they have. And I think there's a strong probability of a different result if Mr. Wagner's words can't be used against him, the words that he apparently were prompted by the question, do you abuse alcohol or drugs?
So you've got a different problem with this record, though, don't you, Mr. Wasilewski? Unless this Court were to interpret, and I don't know what we're going to do you abuse alcohol / drugs, as in and of itself, that one question designed to elicit an incriminating response. Unless we reach that result, we don't have the record of the questions and answers that were asked by the officer's tactic of Mr. Wagner here. And so it's, I mean, when you look at it, it looks like there was a lot of give and take. The state in its brief points out that some of the responses were not to questionings, but it's not clear which. But we don't know which were in response to questions and which were solely in response to this question. So on this record, and I guess my question is, do we look at who has the burden, or do we just look at the record as is, infer that this is the one question we have to analyze, and this just determine whether this question is designed to elicit an incriminating response?
Well, I can only, the only question in the record, you're right, is do you abuse alcohol or drugs, and whether what Officer Saftig's follow-up questions were, or if there were any, from this record, I can't say. And that's why I've argued basically that is the question that led to an incriminating response and was reasonably calculated to do so. If you make the assumption that Officer Saftig was thinking about the degree to which any of these questions might result in inculpatory answers, I don't think that the record is deficient to say what came out as a response to this question. Nobody's saying it came out in response to anything else, and there's nothing expressly stating any of these things were blurred, volunteered, and not in response to questioning. Unfortunately, it doesn't say the opposite either.
But here's the problem, and this is why I asked the question. This question, do you abuse alcohol or drugs? Yes, no. There's a spot to be marked in the column. Unlike some of the other questions listed above, such as have you fainted recently or had a head injury, if yes, when, there's no follow-up question on this form. The question really asks, do you abuse alcohol, drugs? A yes or a no doesn't give you the detail that we have here. But we don't have the record to say there were any other questions.
That's true, Your Honor, and I guess just because something grammatically calls for a yes-no answer doesn't really mean that more than that isn't called for by the question. In the example I gave earlier,
you would concede that yes or no to that question, or would you concede that yes or no to that question doesn't really incriminate? You need more, don't you?
You need more than do you abuse alcohol or drugs?
What are you going to charge him with?
Yes.
What are you going to charge him with? You got to have the possession. You got to have the possession with intent to deliver. You got to have the drug paraphernalia. You need the follow-up question, don't you?
I guess I'd have to grant that just a simple yes to that question isn't the basis for a charge all by itself. But it certainly seems that, well, we don't know if there were follow-ups. I can't fill in the gaps in this record.
All right.
But
maybe grounds for a search warrant. Get the evidence.
What?
Would that be grounds for a search warrant? I'd probably have to concede, since we don't know whether the yes is in response to alcohol, drugs, or both, I think it would be a weak at best basis for a search warrant.
Counsel, why are we forgetting the next question at the bottom of the page? Do you have a drug addiction?
Right.
I mean, I don't hear about that question, but it seems to me that that's a second question that has the same thing. I mean, we have the same problems. We've never focused on it, but it's there. Do you have a drug addiction? I only mention that because you say we don't know if it's drugs or alcohol. Well, they specifically asked it.
My question's been directed, or at least my attention's been directed to that question
above,
and you're absolutely right that there is a drug addiction checkbox there, which implies, of course, more than simple
alcohol.
More than alcohol. And that, then, might be the basis, I think, for a warrant.
Might be illicit, might be prescription drugs, right? People get addicted to prescription drugs, too. So, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, both Mr. Wachlowski and Mr. Castle, for your arguments today on a different case on booking questions. And we'll handle this sometime before June 30th, too. That ends our arguments on 03-1878-CR State versus Wagner. The court We'll meet in conference at 1:15. We will meet for our argument at 1:30. The students should remain, and anyone else who wants to stay is invited, and I will be out in a few moments.